this will do, we've got enough people here. As long as there's one person here, I'll give a talk. So, today's talk, I did promise yesterday, will be on deep insight. So this is tying up that how meditation and the process of wisdom works together. And sometimes it needs to be understood what actually wisdom is and how it arises. Because sometimes that when we practice meditation, we sometimes think that wisdom is something different than what we're doing, or we're not really quite sure how do you get wise. Where does all these great insights come from? And the way the Buddha taught, the way it actually works in practice, you are on the path to insight when you practice in this way. By calming the mind down, you are increasing the power of your mindfulness. And not only just increasing its strength, but also its ability to stay on one object, to really penetrate and find out what it truly is. Because a lot of the time that either our mindfulness, the ability of knowing, is not powerful enough, so it only sees superficially on the nature of things, or it never stays long enough to fully understand what's going on. So one can understand, I think just through reason, that to get insight you have to allow the mind to stay on one thing for long periods of time, have stillness, have stability to sustain your attention, and number two, to have a very powerful mindfulness. The powerful mindfulness is just like having a bright light. The brighter the light, the more detail you see. And those are the two jobs of mindfulness which give rise to wisdom, both its intensity and its stillness. So when I talk like that, you can understand why it's important to develop the meditation in this way. Actually, when I talk about stillness and intensity, the two always go together. The more still you are, the more intense is the mindfulness, eventually. And this is where I start talking about the empowering of mindfulness. The empowering of mindfulness comes when you're still and the mind becomes bright. Some of you have experienced that as a sort of a pre-limiter. The mind is like bright, it's like there's a light there somewhere, but it's not focused at all, but still your mind is becoming bright. And that sort of brightness is a sign that the mind is becoming more powerful. As that brightness increases, the experience is that whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you feel with greater depth, with greater intensity. And there's many, many stories which I have about how that happens in practice and how strange it is to get your mindfulness strengthened with the power of samadhi, with the power of meditation. And because many times at my first meditation retreat, when we used to have, there was only in small boarding houses, and so that we didn't have any gardens like we have here, so we were allowed to go for a walk for 1 hour every morning. I went for a walk to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. At the entrance there was this clump of bamboo. And that clump of bamboo was so beautiful that I couldn't walk any further. Instead of exercising, first of all I just stood, sort of entranced by a clump of bamboo, and after standing for a while, there was a bench close by, I sat down and just gazed at it for the whole hour. It was just enchanting, it was magical. I'd never seen anything so beautiful for a long time. And so after the hour was finished, I had to get back, guess what for, for breakfast. So I decided to go back there the next day. And the next day, out of the 9 days, 8 days, I went to that clump of bamboo. And it was delightful. And of course, at that time, I wasn't really given in-depth teachings. I didn't really know what was going on. And I thought I'd just stumbled across an exceptionally beautiful piece of nature. But what happened next was after the retreat was finished, when I went back to studies, and I had a free afternoon, I decided to go and visit the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world. I got on my bicycle, and I drove, or rather rode, through the Cambridge traffic to the botanical gardens, and there at the entrance was this spindly, dry, dusty, it was actually quite a pathetic piece of bamboo. But it really struck me, why does it now look just so awful when a few days earlier it was just so beautiful? And of course, this is where insight comes, the experience, the data which you have, you actually understand the meaning of this, the relationships between your experiences. And it became quite clear to me that it wasn't a bamboo which was beautiful, it was my mind was beautiful. My mind was strong and powerful, and I could see things in there that now I couldn't see anymore. When you've been tired, struggling through the Cambridge traffic, been doing all your exams, playing around in your parties, your mind was so dull that I couldn't see any depth in that bamboo anymore. Of course, that's a shock, because I realize that dullness is how I usually live. Our minds aren't powerful at all. Our minds are very, very dull and tired. That's why they never have much powerful mindfulness. And one of the other times was in a monastery in Thailand, one of my first range retreat, or second range retreat rather. We had this new hall, and in the hall, this is Wat Nana Chat, some of the monks would know that hall, they had a concrete floor which was laid by the villagers, and that concrete was not very well done. But nevertheless, it was all bumpy. And usually that, you know, when the concrete workers, the granite workers, when they smooth the concrete, they usually put a bit of water and a bit of cement on it. The villagers just use spit. Oh, it was gross. So I don't know what was in that spit, but it was all sorts of different colours. Well, not really great colours, but all different colours of grey. And that's an important part of the story, because during the monsoon season, of course, it's really hard to walk meditation out in the rain, so you're walking inside. You're walking backwards and forwards, 2 meters in front of me. We're watching 2 meters in front with my eyes. Just being present moment, being silent, trying to focus on the feet. Because I was actually just gazing, just without really looking for anything, at the concrete floor 2 meters in front of me, suddenly I had to stop. Because that concrete started becoming incredibly beautiful. I started to notice all the different shades of grey and just the way they were arranged in this amazing pattern. And just then the texture of the whole thing stood out. And I actually stood awestruck at the most beautiful piece of concrete I'd ever seen in my life. And I just gazed at it for I don't know how many minutes. And of course the thought came in that, you know, I should really cut this out and send it to maybe the Tate Gallery in London. Or some other sort of museum of art. Because that's wasted on the floor. It's just so amazingly beautiful. It's only an old piece of concrete. Well, the point was that why was it opening up like that to me? Why did it look so beautiful? It closed up afterwards, and now, shame of shame, the abbot, after I left, covered it all over with plastic tiles. That work of art is hidden from view. But the point is, it wasn't really a work of art. My mind was a work of art at that time. Because it was so still, the mindfulness started to get strong. You started to see amazing things which you thought were never there. Even this carpet in front of you. This is really an old, cheap carpet. And they can't afford very much, obviously, because we probably don't pay them enough. Whatever it is. And it's not exactly a high-quality carpet which you're sitting on here. But there might come a time when you get into deep meditation. Your mind gets very, very still, and you get lots of energy coming up. The mind gets bright, and happiness comes naturally, and you feel so good. You open your eyes and you go, wow, look at that. All the different colours of green, the different shades, and the way it all comes together, the whole texture of the carpet. Wow, that's amazing. This is what happens to you, because the mind becomes bright, and it starts to see deeply into things. And not only that, but it can stay on something long enough to give you all the information. Now this is understanding where insight is coming from. A mind which is empowered. And that's what I've already said. You go outside, you look at a tree, and you see things in there which ordinary people don't see. Your mind is bright and can see more deep. But more than that is you have to have the stillness as well. Because without the stillness, the senses don't have time to register the details. A common simile which I give, the road up to my monastery. 10 years going up there in a car, then I decided to walk up there. Walking up there, the hillside changed, so I stopped and just stood. Many of you know that story. It's a very great simile for what meditation is and how stillness and insight go together. Going up a car for 10 years or more, I thought I knew that hillside up to Serpentine. Many of you have gone up that hillside many times in a car. I challenge you to get out of your car and walk one day. And you'll see things you've never seen before. Stand, and you'll see other things which were hidden from you when you were looking through the window of a speeding car. When that happened to me, I couldn't understand. How come I never seen these pieces of scenery? These rocks, these blades of grass, these bushes. And of course, it became very obvious. When you just think about it a few moments. When you're looking through the window of a car, your senses don't have time. They've got to register something, the mind's got to figure it out very quickly, you've got to go on to something else. So the image doesn't really register. It's like taking a photograph and the exposure time is too short. You only get sort of an outline of what's there. Or you're taking a recording and the batteries are flat. So it's sort of dull. You can only just about hear the sound. That's your normal life. Going so fast that life doesn't fully register. That's like going in a car. When you slow down, you start to see more. Because your senses have time. Things can register. The batteries in the machine are just stronger. The lights are brighter. And you're going slow enough that everything can register. And when that happens, you see more deeply into things. But the strange thing about that experience for me was not just the detail what I saw, but the whole thing started to look more beautiful. I never seen a hillside look so pretty. And then when you stopped, of course, the senses have as much time as they need, they got full time to have the image on your retina fully formed, have the mind being able to fully know it without having to rush to something else. Like food, to be able to fully taste the food, the toast or whatever, to fully taste it without having to rush off to something else. You're fully with what's going on when you stop. And that's why that when I stopped, the hillside looked just the most amazing. Saw so much detail there. Things which I never expected to be in there. And the whole thing just looked so amazingly beautiful. That was what happens when you slow down. The sign of insight is depth of perception and also bliss. If it's not blissful, it means the imprint is not powerful enough. So that's why that you have these insights, first of all, just by chance. You know, just on the ordinary things of life. Whether it's, you know, the carpet, or whether it's the flowers outside, or a clump of bamboo, or pieces of concrete, ordinary things, or a brick in the wall. Suddenly to you, you'll see that this is amazingly beautiful. And that's a sign that the mind is becoming powerful enough, still enough, to see things there which people normally don't see. Remember, the enlightenment is not common for people. Not many people become enlightened. And why is that? They're all, are they awake? Are they aware? They're not really awake. They're not really aware. The mind is going too fast. It's too tired. The batteries are run down. It's not powerful. That's why people don't become enlightened. So first of all, we have to empower the mindfulness. Get it still. Then we can start seeing things. Now, second part is, what do you want to see? We're not here to get insight into the beauty of a carpet, nor are we here to actually to become aesthetes on concrete, and to be able to see the most beautiful concrete in Perth. The whole point of this is to see that what the Buddha saw, the answer to the great questions of life. One, of course, is what's true happiness. Other ones is, you know, who are you? What you're supposed to be doing here, in this life. Those are like the great questions. And this is actually what one does in the practice of meditation. In particular, to get insight into one of the most important questions, which is not theoretical or philosophical. It's just something which is so important to you, something which motivates your every moment in life, what happiness is, and what pain and suffering is. You find yourself becoming more concerned of not becoming, but you find that you always were more concerned about happiness and suffering than anything else in your whole life. It is happiness and suffering which motivate you, which run the machine called you, the search for happiness, the avoidance of pain in all its different forms. Even the food you take, why do you take that food and not another food? It's not for the sake of happiness. Why do you come here for the sake of happiness? Why do you do anything? Mostly for the sake of happiness, avoidance of pain. But you've been trying that all your life, and why is it you still haven't got it right? Look at all of you who got married. How long did you spend choosing your husband? How many months did you look at your wife? Is she the right one? Sometimes, as I said this, you spend more time choosing a partner in life than you do choosing your car. But you're usually much more happy with your car than you. Why is that? Because we get it wrong too often. We don't know what happiness, we don't know what suffering is. But this is actually where you're going to really find out. Because as you get into meditation, you start to actually see what's going on. In particular, you start to really understand what attachments are. And it's wonderful knowing this thing about attachment, because my goodness, that in Buddhism it's such an important word, attachment, attachment, attachment. People say you should give up your attachment. They haven't got a clue what attachments are, just give them up. And all they end up doing is giving up what they don't want to have, and they keep what they do want to have. That's not the attachment. So they tell monks, monk, you're just attached to being, your brown robe. You're just afraid of life. You're just afraid of committing yourself to relationships, you monks. So you're just attached to being a monk. I say, no, come on, being a monk is letting go. So you can't be attached to it. They don't know what your attachments are. And some people actually used to go and see Ajahn Chah, I remember, they said, look, they said, I'm a lay person, I have sex, but I'm not attached to it. Big groan. He used to say, look, that's like saying you can eat salt without, or you can have salt without salt being salty. That salt is salty. So sex is attachment. You can't get out of that. However, that people say, no, I'm not attached to it. Or you can do this as long as you're mindful. And the whole thing is absolutely stupid. Because it's not really realizing what attachments truly are. Now, in the practice you have been doing already, you have come across many attachments. And those are the attachments which stop you getting deeper in your meditation. Are you attached to food? If you weren't attached to food, you wouldn't be worried last night about, when's breakfast going to be? You wouldn't be so hungry. Are you attached to your body? If you weren't attached to your body, you'd be able to let it go very easily. And just the whole thing disappears. Whenever you get fear in meditation because something starts to disappear, you can't feel your hands, or you can't feel your legs, or you can't feel your breath. Why are you afraid? Because that's showing what attachment is. The only time when we can have real understanding what attachment is when it begins to be taken away from us. The only time you really understand if you're attached to the body is when you go to the doctor and say, I'm sorry, you've got cancer, you haven't got long to live. Now, you'll know whether you're attached to your body or not. Sometimes even monks, been monks for many years, say, I'm not attached to my body, I know it's just hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, a bit of flesh, a bit of bone, it's all that, I know that, I've done anatomy, I've done biology, that's all it is. And they say, you've got cancer. That's all theory. It's not yet, never really tested it. So here in the meditation, you're testing it. You've got to completely let go of this body. Why can't we do that? It's fascinating why we can't. Every time you get stuck in meditation, it's because there's an attachment there. So every time you get stuck in meditation, that's marvelous. You've unearthed an attachment. Now it's a job of insight. Find out, why am I not going deeper? Why can't I let this go? This is where you investigate. You just stand and look until you find why you're attached. It's the same with thinking. Why is it that people can't stop thinking? It's the most craziest of things, because you know you don't have to think at all. In this retreat, you know, it's quite clear. You have nothing to think about. You have no jobs to be done. You don't have to plan anything. You don't have to remember anything. You've got nothing to do. So why do you keep thinking? You're so used to thinking, you become attached to it. You think that's you. I am the me, the thinker. This is what I do. I think. I think, therefore I am, said Descartes. Exactly. So stop thinking and you might disappear and have some peace for change. So start to think. The only reason you're thinking is because of attachment to thinking. It's not that sometimes people are telling me in their meditation, they say, well, I'm just sitting here, just the thoughts come by themselves. Then no, they don't. You invite them in. Say, come on, thoughts, come on. thoughts never come into your mind by themselves. You open the door and go outside, drag them in sometimes. Maybe not see that, maybe not honest to that, but that's what you do. You want to think. You delight in thinking. You're attached to thinking. Now these are the attachments which are important. A lot of the time it's attachment is because that's who we think we are, we don't know anything more than that. When we get silent again, we get scared because we're not used to that. We're afraid of the unknown. We're attached to the what is usual for us. So here, we're actually cutting those attachments. We're going beyond them. We see them, we let them go. When we let them go, they've disappeared. Non-attachment is always seen when those things completely disappear. They're gone, they're finished with. If you're not attached to your body, it will vanish in your meditation. If you're not attached to your family, it will vanish in your meditation. If you're not attached to your money, it will vanish in the donation box. Whatever! There's all these things you're attached to, so just allow them to let it go. If I'm attached to my monastery, I keep thinking about it when I'm here. If you're attached to your loved ones, you keep wanting to ring them up. How are you? I wonder what your wife is doing. You've been away for 6 or 7 days. Do you think she's being faithful? I've got to ring them up and find out. But the thing is, it's just attachment. Attachment creates worry. Attachment means you can't be free of these things. So, this is where you're learning about attachments. But the deep attachments, they're the ones where we really get the deep insights. Because this is why a lot of people get into the point, let go of their body. I mean, that should be easy enough to understand you're not your body. Let go of the body in meditation and say you've just got this beautiful breath or the beautiful nimitta and the body's completely gone and disappeared. At least then, you know what this body is. It's not really important. You know that's going to happen when you die. So at least you won't be afraid of death anymore when you get to that stage of meditation. That's just the old body going and good riddance to it. My goodness, doesn't this body ache? Now even, I've allowed you to sleep as much as you want. You can only sit for however much you want. You can get as many cushions as you want. You can sit on chairs, but how many of you still ache? What more can you do to get this body having no aches and pains? And of course, you can't do very much with this body. It always has aches and pains. That's why the only time when it's at peace is when it's gone. The only time I can get peace in my body, there's always something going on there. Just to go into meditation, you can't feel the body at all. That's the only time the body's got peacefulness. And it's completely let go of. The more times you do that, the more times you get detached from your body, don't care about it. You look after it, but you're not really afraid of it going. So that's a way you can get off the attachment to death. That's not a problem anymore, it's not a big deal. At least that's something you've learnt, if you can get that far in meditation. And that's an insight which you see is very valuable in your ordinary daily life. Your own death or other people's death, it's death, that's all. So what? Big deal. And death is not such a life and death issue anymore. It's just death, that's all. So when we can actually understand that, at least it's going to let us be free of a lot of suffering in life. But I like the deeper insights in meditation, because this is much closer to fundamental Buddhist teachings, the sort of stuff which gets you enlightened. Because when you get to those deeper stages of meditation, you come across a very refined attachment. And these are the ones which keep you getting reborn, which keep you suffering. These are the root attachments. You can see that when you get so still with animitta. It's not just the body going, not just the five senses going. That's actually quite huge, actually, to be able to let those go. But to let will disappear. And that's a frightening one. Because of our attachments, that's the second most deep attachment. The attachment to be in control, to do. Your attachment to what we call will. You just can't leave anything alone. You just can't let go. You always have to be the driver. Maybe not the driver of other people. Usually the driver of your husband or the driver of your wife. You always want to control them in your subtle ways. You can't just let them be themselves. You want to change them to make them nice and cuddly. But at least you want to change yourself. You want to be in control of yourself. You think that it's my responsibility, my body and my mind. And this is where we strive and struggle. We're attached to the striving. We're attached to the struggling. That's why we never know peace. We never know freedom from the struggle that is the will. It's amazing when you can actually see that will is not necessary. The will is impermanent, it rises and falls, it can disappear like anything else. It's subject to cessation, to complete disappearance. It's not you. I always have fun when I start to talk of the fact that there is no such thing as a will coming from you. Will is, it's a phenomena, but it doesn't originate from you. I have great fun with this because they get really, people sometimes get quite scared. But if I'm not in charge, who is? Ooh, am I in the way in charge? Am I brainwashing you? Am I manipulating your minds? Am I sort of in this very sneaky way controlling your every action, getting power over you? To do with as I want in the future. It's scary! I sometimes ask people, did you decide to come on this retreat? Who told you to come here? Why are you sitting in this position right now? Was that your own free will? Did you decide to do that? Why are you here? When I say, you had no choice, you had to be sitting here, you had to come. There's no choice at all. And I prove that, you see, you're here. Now what we're doing here, we're getting to five areas. Why is it that you buy that particular item of clothing? Or that particular item of food, or that type of car, when you buy a car. Have you got free choice when you go into the supermarket? Or are you, is your will completely conditioned by the advertisements you see on the television or in the glossy pages in the magazine or on the roadside? How many of you truly think you're influenced by those advertisements? No one thinks they're influenced by the advertisements. We all feel we're far too sophisticated for that. And we watch those advertisements, yeah, but we don't believe that sort of stuff. But you later on go and buy that sort of stuff. Look, for example, like designer clothing. And that's completely ridiculous. Just because there's a name on it doesn't mean it's any better. Even if you got the name on, you get a Rolex watch, probably in Malaysia, which costs $10. So what's the difference between one of those ones and ones you actually get in the shop in Perth for a couple of $1,000? They both tell the time. So what's the difference? Ah, because you've been convinced that it's got Rolex, it must be better. Or you must be sort of more attractive because you've got the Rolex watch. You all know that story of when we had this inn when I was a young man. There was an advertisement I remember seeing on television for St. Bruno tobacco. And I remember this advertisement very clearly because this ordinary looking guy wasn't particularly beautiful or attractive, just an ordinary looking guy. He's walking down this street and he got out his pipe and sought some Bruno tobacco in and lit it up. And once the aroma of this tobacco started wafting down the street, he went into a bank and this incredibly beautiful girl working behind the bank, she smelled it and she was smitten. She jumped over the counter and followed him behind him, completely enamored. And then someone in the chemist shop, an equally beautiful girl, so she was enamored. She also came out of the shop and she was following him in about 2 or 3 minutes. Had all these amazingly beautiful girls following him because that's what St. Bruno tobacco does. At least that's what's implied in the advertisement. It makes you completely irresistible to young women. It's crazy, isn't it? Stupid. But guess who bought some St. Bruno tobacco? It never worked for me. Maybe it did, I would have been a muck. Why do we do things like that? And I thought, my goodness, you're supposed to be intelligent. That's why advertisements work. You think you have the choice, you don't remember why. The causes and reasons why you have the will, the choice to buy that brand of tobacco. Or why you choose to have that particular hairstyle. Or why you choose to wear that particular type of jewellery. Or why you choose, why is it you choose to come to this retreat here? It's advertising, that's all. Marketing. But the point is that here we're going to really challenge all that marketing business. Because after a while you see, why do I do these things? Sometimes I looked at myself and say, why do I teach like this? Where do all these words come from? And when I investigate that with stillness, I see that many of those words come from Ajahn Chah, from the other teachers who have inspired me. The jokes come from my father, because that's what he used to do. I've been conditioned. Ajahn Brahm is no person, Ajahn Brahm. It's just a result of all the influences which I've had over the years. All coming together. And that causes me to speak like this. I've got no choice. I have to tell silly jokes. So the point is, you're actually seeing exactly where your will comes from. Why you're willing. One of the great stories was when I was, again, in university, I was a member of the Psychic Research Society, and, you know, into psychic things, into spooky things and stuff like that. And every year we used to get a hypnotist to come and give a talk. And there's always somebody who could be hypnotized. And it was always great fun, because it made this poor student do stupid things. Because he didn't realise what he was doing. We were howling with laughter. And one of the stupid things they told a student to do, I remember this, the hypnotist said, later on, I'm going to touch the lobe of my right ear. When I do that, you will stand up and sing the British national anthem, God Save the Queen. He said, but not now, when I touch my ear. And I'm going to take you out of hypnosis now. You won't remember anything which I've said. But the post-hypnotic suggestion, when I touch my right earlobe, you'll stand up and sing God Save the Queen. And he was a great entertainer, this hypnotist, because he'd take him out of hypnosis. And of course, myself and all my friends, from that time on, we weren't listening to what the hypnotist was saying, just watching his hand and see when he was going to touch his earlobe. And being a great entertainer, sometimes he'd move it quite close and take it away again. He had us waiting, just building up the tension. But then finally he touches my earlobe. And this poor student would actually stand up in front of everybody and start singing God Save. And of course, we almost sort of wet ourselves with laughter. It was so funny. But this fellow, even though we were laughing at him, he would not stop until he finished singing God Save the Queen. And then the crunch, the most important point, and it's not just for fun. The Yet Hymn Minister was asking, why did you sing God Save the Queen? And this poor student said, because I felt I needed to. I felt it was an important thing to do. To the student, it was an act of free will. At least that's what it appeared to be. He could distinguish that what to us was obvious was not his free will at all. He'd been compelled by hypnosis to sing that. To him, it appeared as free will. There was no subjective difference. When I saw that and contemplated it, it made me very scared. All of which I thought was my free will perhaps may not be free after all. And now I realize none of it's free. It's all conditioned. You've got no choice. So you might as well just sit down and let go. Now, what it actually does is, if there's no choice, where's the point for self? Where's the point for guilt, for striving and everything else? No point to it anymore. So you begin to unwind your control of the world and your destiny. You begin to stop. You let go, you stop. And then you get very, very peaceful. When you realize that will doesn't belong to you, it's not part of you, it's not a possession of you. When it doesn't belong to you, when it's not a possession of you, you can throw it away. It's not mine, nothing to do with me. So then your will doesn't concern you anymore. When you can understand that, and the reason why I mention this at this particular point, is it makes it much easier to stop controlling when you get to the point of nimittas, or even before, to really relax and just allow it to happen. You weren't in control anyway. So why start controlling now? Allow it to happen. And also, there's no ego involved. It's not you who do the jhanas. In fact, there's none of you here can enter a jhana. You have to disappear first to enter the jhanas. I can't enter jhanas. I can't go into jhana. I have to put I down first of all, put all that will aside, and then the jhanas happen. That's why there cannot be any attachment in the jhanas. That was just the attachment the I is left a long time before. That's why Mara, what we said last night, can't come into jhanas. Mara is blindfolded, can't see those states. Because the I has to be put aside. So what happens when I talk like this? I am actually brainwashing you. I'm conditioning you. I'm putting that suggestion in there so that when you get into that deep state of meditation, it will be possible for you to put aside the will, to stop controlling, to stop doing, and completely abandon. Let go. So that you can experience that jhana. When you experience that jhana for yourself, you come out afterwards, then you know the truth of what I've just been saying. Because in the jhanas there is no will. Now you're getting an insight which is powerful. Not an ordinary insight. An insight into something which is going to change the way you look at life. When you actually see that for yourself, I just give you the suggestion, and the suggestion is enough to allow it to happen. Once it does happen, it's not a suggestion, it becomes a truth. That shocks you when you find out you're not in control. You never were. It's just this process of cause and effect creates the will. Will is, you can see it happening, but it doesn't come from you. Or anybody else. Just a mass of causes. conditions giving rise to their effects. And when you can see that and you can let go of that will, then you can be still. It is the will which moves the world. When the world disappears, all the movement stops. You get this beautiful state of absolute stillness. And of course, you can call it stillness, but you don't know what that really means until you get into that stillness. Absolute diamond hard immovability. But still, beautiful awareness. Now when you have those experiences, that's where we get the insights. I gave a hint to this yesterday when I talked about the simile of the tadpole. A tadpole has been born in water, lived all its life in water, has always grown up in water. So the tadpole, it's impossible for the tadpole to know what water is. It's always been there. Can you know what will is? Even I've been talking about it. Do you fully know what it is? Or is it just like the water for a tadpole? It's always been there. So you can't really fully understand what it is. However, when you get into that first jhana, I've given you some theoretical ideas what will is. When you get into that first jhana, especially the second jhana, one of the most prominent features of that state is there's no will left. It's like the tadpole's grown into a frog and has left the water. At that point, the frog, previously a tadpole, same sort of stream of consciousness, same stream of being. Now it knows what water was. Ah, that's what water is. Because now it's left it. It's got perspective. When you go to the states of no will, absolute stillness, but even the potential to do has disappeared, then you have an understanding what will is. Then you'll understand what I mean, that will is not you. You're not the one who does. You are not in control. So when you see that, you can start to let go. Letting go becomes much easier when the doing, what you're abandoning, doesn't belong to me. It's much easier to give other people's money away than to give your own money away. There's this old story from Sufi tradition of this. It's called one of the Mulla Nasruddin stories. It's a beautiful story. They had in their village this very, very saintly monk. And they loved him so much, he was so wise, he was so helpful, he was always there, he could be so sharp and solve people's problems. So when this monk started to get very, very old, they all clubbed together to get some money to get a doctor to make sure he lived a long time. But even so, the doctor said, well, you know, it's old age, everyone's got to die. I think it's about time now. I don't think this monk has got long to live. Oh, and that really devastated the whole village. So they met together. How can we keep our wonderful monk here a bit longer? What can we do? And when they were thinking, someone came up with a brainwave. They said, I know what we can do. Why don't, because they're Muslims, why don't we ask Allah that I'll give 2 days of my life. Take 2 days off my life and give it to the monk so he can live longer. I donate 2 whole days of my life. They thought that's a wonderful idea. Maybe sort of Allah will do that. And so someone else came, 2 days, I'll give a whole 7 days. And they all came, well done. And someone said, I'll give a whole month. A whole month, that's a long time of your life. Said, no, it's for a good cause, I'll give a whole month. And then this Nasruddin fellow said, I give 7 years. And everyone said, that's a really, are you sure you want to do this? He said, I give 7 years. Bravo, bravo. What a wonderful donation. Give up 7 years of your life, you know, to help this monk. He said, oh no, it's not 7 years of my life, I give 7 years of my wife's life. Why are you laughing? Your sexist discrimination. That's a Muslim joke. It's very funny though. It's very easy to give up away something which doesn't belong to you. In the same way that you can give up the will when you realise it's not me or mine. You can let go of the body when it's not yours. You can let, say, your wife or your child, your husband, your parent, you can let them go into death when it's not yours. When it's my wife, when it's my child, you won't be able to let them go. So my, which is the problem. So when you actually see this, it's much easier to let go of the will. Half of suffering is gone. Half of the illusion of self is gone. You get the insight, the first half of the insight into anatta, not self. The will is not me. It doesn't belong to me, just an empty process. Now you go even deeper. Because whilst the will is gone, you've still got consciousness, you've still got knowing left. And the last part of insight is to see, what is this one who knows? Who is listening to me now? What is knowing that you're listening to me? What is this consciousness? That's a fun part to find out. Because it's only when you have that full consciousness, and the whole purpose of these deeper jhanas is to see that consciousness get less and less and less, to see the layers of it peel away. What's at the heart of the Dhamma? At this point, I give the simile of the Russian dolls. This is the only visual aid I've ever used. I usually say the simile of the thousand petal lotus. But the thousand petal lotus works like this. They have this term in Tibetan Buddhism, Om Mani Padme Hum. It literally means like hail or homage to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. What is that jewel in the heart to the lotus? Listen, and you will find out. And lotus, as everybody knows, closes up its petals at night. But in the early morning, when the first rays of the sun hit that lotus, the outermost leaves can warm up. It's only because they're warmed up that those outermost petals open out. And once they've opened out, it means the rays of the sun can hit the next layer of petals. So after a short while, that too can open out. Every layer of petals needs the warmth of the sun for it to open out. That's why they open out in turn. One inside the other, they open out. But if the sun goes behind a cloud and it loses the heat, the petals close up one after the other again. In that simile, your sustained mindfulness, unconditional mindfulness, that's what opens up the many layers of petals called you. You have to sustain your mindfulness, and then something opens up and you go deeper. That's why the outside layer of petals is just this. If you put sustained mindfulness on that, that opens out, past and future disappear. You come to what's in the center of time, now. When you sustain your attention on the now, just like layers of petals, if you sustain your attention on the present moment long enough, then without moving, if the sun moves for a moment, things close up again, you've got to keep the warmth on there, unmoving, unconditional, then that layer of petals opens out, and you see the silence, which is in the middle of the present moment. Just like one doll inside the other. That's present moment awareness. That's silence. It's right inside. You don't have to throw this one away. Say, I've done present moment awareness. Where's silence? Where's silence? Where's silence? Present silence is within the present moment. And there you got silence. Now you sustain your attention on that silence. Just like the leaf will open up. And you can see the breath. Right inside the silence, that's where you find the breath. I don't know how many is in here, this is And right inside the breath. You don't have to throw the breath away, because sometimes people are watching their breath and say, what am I supposed to do next? Don't move. If the sun moves away, the petals close up again. You see, it just goes and closes up. And you've lost the breath. Where's the breath gone? Because you haven't kept your mindfulness. Unconditional sustained mindfulness. And then you get to see the breath. Then what do we do next? Inside the breath is the beautiful breath. Sometimes it's hard to get to the stage of the beautiful breath. Sometimes it's a bit stiff. You get to the beautiful breath. Now, of course, it's very small and very fine, beautiful breath. You stay in this attention. After a while, the petals open out. It's time for the beautiful breath. Is it there? Don't get excited. Because inside the beautiful breath is the limiter. You see? There it is, and it's gone again because you're excited. That's called the ping pong limiter. That's what happens to most people. It comes up. And then it goes away again. You get too excited. You get too afraid. It's very scary inside here. But here, we're in that unconditioned mindfulness and stillness. You're letting go of things, of will especially. You're not trying to open it very hard. Just allow it to open, and there inside is a beautiful refined limiter. Oh, that's really nice. Isn't that beautiful? It's tiny, but it's just so amazing. You've never seen anything like this before in your life. People say, what do I do next? What do I do next? If you say that, everything disappears. But if you just have the limiter, then inside that, only a few people can actually open up the limiter and see what's inside. The next stage is inside the one you're in now. And that's actually how these things happen. But inside the nimitta is the jhana. And this is where what's actually disappeared is like the will. You're going really deep inside to see what's in the heart of you. You've gone inside your body. You're starting to go inside your mind now. You've gone so far inside the mind that the will, which is on the outside of the mind, it's not essential. It's not central to the mind. It's disappeared. That's when you have the insight based on experience that that's not me, that's not mine. That's a peripheral phenomena. When you go into the jhanas, those innermost petals, like the innermost petals of most flowers, are the most delicate, the most beautiful, the most fragrant. It's the inner ones where all the action is. And then you open up the jhanas. Second jhana, just like these doors, is right within the first jhana. You don't have to go anywhere. You just stay the first jhana. Sustain attention on it. You can't do anything otherwise. That's all that happens anyway. Then the second jhana, the first jhana opens out, as it were, to reveal the second jhana, which is just a refinement of the first. And after a while, that second jhana opens out, just like the petals of a lotus to see the third jhana. That opens out the fourth jhana. That opens out the immaterial states. And the reason why they're immaterial states is a part of what you thought was consciousness. It's just peeling away. You're going into the heart of knowing. The jewel in the heart of the lotus. What's in the center of everything. On the last layer of petals is called the state of neither perception nor no perception. Is it consciousness or is it not consciousness? It's neither is nor isn't. The most refined experience you could have. The last layer of petals. When that opens out, right in the middle, there, you see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The essence of you. The Dhamma, the origin, the source, where everything comes from. You know,
I got excited now.
You know, what is that jewel in the heart of the lotus? What do you see? Shall I tell you? It is emptiness. There's nothing there. Anatta. Now that's what we call insight. Going right in and see the center of things. If you don't believe me, go and have a look for yourself. Ajahn Chah once had this wonderful experience with my teacher. When he was maybe 1 year from when he had his, he stopped teaching. He had his last year of teaching. He was getting quite sickly. So in our monastery, we built a sauna, especially for our teacher. Actually, in the old days, the monks were allowed to build saunas. It's in the old books. Even in the time of the Buddha, they built saunas for the sake of health. We read that in the books, and we thought, why don't we build one? They're very simple to build, and that might help our teacher. But it wasn't just out of compassion for him. There's some selfishness as well, because getting the teacher to the monastery would not just mean you could wash one of his toes when he came back from Amsterdam. It also meant that he would give a talk. And so once a week he'd come to our monastery for a sauna and give us a talk, a Dhamma talk. And on this one occasion, he gave us a really beautiful Dhamma talk. And I was so inspired. But when the talk had finished, when Ajahn Chah went off to have his sauna, I let other monks look after him. Usually, you know, you go and look after your teacher. Maybe just doing small things like help wash his bathing cloth or put his robes up on the line or hang up his towel or something. But that day there was many other monks, so I let them go and help Ajahn Chah. And I went to the back of the hall just to sit meditation. When you're inspired, it's so easy to meditate. I had a very beautiful meditation, I don't know how long, which is so lovely, so peaceful, so deep. When I came out, there was no one around. I didn't know what the time was, so I thought, first thought was maybe I should go and see my teacher. Maybe I can still do something for him. So I got up and started walking to the sauna. But I was too late. Ajahn Chah had finished his sauna, because we crossed on the path. He was coming with two Thai men. He was going back to his car to leave. So we passed, the two Thai men, my teacher Ajahn Chah, and myself, we were crossing. And monks, they know if someone's had a deep meditation. Ajahn Chah took one look at me. And one of those looks which go right through you. Now you know that the fellow's reading your mind. He looked and he saw I had a deep meditation. So he tried to enlighten me. He said, Brahma Wangsa. That's the full name, Brahma Wangsa. Brahma Wangsa, why? He asked me the deepest question of all, why? When in this dual state of mind, you hear the right question. Sometimes that's enough of a trigger. However, for me, I said, I don't know. That was completely stupid. I didn't know what to answer to a question like that. And Ajahn Chah at the time was looking really serious, and as soon as I said that, you just burst out laughing. He never criticized you or called you stupid, he just thought everything was just so funny. So he burst out laughing. Then he looked serious again. And he said, Brahma Wangsa, I'm going to tell you the answer. If anyone asks you that question again, why? This is the answer. Do you want to know the answer? He said, the answer to the question why is, there is nothing. My mirai. There is nothing. He looked at me and said, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, there you go. There is nothing. So that's the answer to the question why. Jewel in the heart of the lotus. Emptiness. There is nothing. Do you understand?
No, you don't.
Because that's what insight is. You can't understand that. You've got to go and see it first of all, find out what's going on. Seeing in. Real insights. You only do that through stillness and through sustaining your attention, opening up the lotus,
so you can actually see, experience what's inside. You can experience what's in the heart of stillness. What's in the heart of the knowing. Find out the real big answers to the big question, why. You can't do that through thought, through inference, through experience. That's why you do need stillness for insight. Insight is the stillness. The two dance around each other all the way into Nibbana. So that's the talk today on deep insights. Whether you like it or not, you're getting still, insights will happen. Insights happen, you like it or not, you get more still. Nothing to do with you, there's no one in there. So just sit down, shut up, and enjoy the practice. So any questions about deep insight? No? Yeah, okay, go on.
Ajahn, you were talking about conditioning.
Yeah.
Does the previous love conditioning have effect on this love?
Yes, it does. You know why you had to ask that question? You probably asked that question many times before. Yeah, it does have some influence on your past life. Your past life has some influence on this life. But all those influences are just influences, that's all. There's always change, this growth. Just like the last mango tree had an influence on the seed. So the next mango tree has got some similar characteristics. But it's not the same characteristics. There's always mutations of your ignorance into wisdom. So isn't that wonderful? You can mutate. Is that what you're asking? Any other questions? Here, go.
I was mentioning about the lotus using sunlight to kind of open up the petals.
Yeah.
Can we kind of like using the artificial light to open it up? For example, like when we are meditating, if we are in a group, does the energy help to elevate us much faster?
Yes, it does. It's the energies of the group, the energies of the place. That's why sometimes it's helpful to meditate together. If you've got some good meditators there, they'll actually bring you up. If you've got some real, JoJo meditators there, well, they might bring you down. No, you don't, you can bring them up. And get inspired to self-compassion. And there's also places of that energy as well. Like I was saying, the holy place in India. Or these other places where you can go to. It's very, very still. It's so easy to meditate. I've found in your energies of places, that's the truth. Here's what's happened there before. If you get places where people have got deep meditation, like some of the monks will agree to this, but when I did my 6-month retreat in Serpentine, after I came out, because I was coming out, I had to go do my abbot's job again. So I had to go and move back to the abbot's hut. So the hut where I did my 6-month retreat was vacant. So the monks were actually vying for who would go there and get into the energy. And the one monk who actually was selected or got to go there after me said the first day he couldn't go in. Even though that's his heart now, he just couldn't go in, it was just too strong. The energy is... It's true, sometimes it's like that. You get really empowered. Okay, at the back here.
What I don't understand is if you have given up for the will, the consciousness, everything else, and you go back inside, what caused it then for you to come back to reality?
What caused you to come back is just the old karma. It's impermanent, these things don't last. So, because even those states are impermanent, you go so deep. And then, basically, I think it's because of the body hasn't died yet. You come out again. However, the body has died, you go in. When it fades away, everything fades away. That's what I was saying last night about the jhana anagami. A person dies and they're streaming within a jhana. Then they just go to that realm. When that realm fades, they fade. They never come out. So sometimes, you don't come out. It's a wonderful place to go. This incredible bliss.
whenever this finishes, everything finishes. If you want more to happen after that, we've had enough with existence and samsara. Anyway, at the back, first of all, then you next.
Yes, Ajahn. The question is, for a lay person, so normally you practice at home, what is the suggested time for us to practice in
the afternoon? Okay, the suggested time to practice at home. The only time to practice is?
Now.
Correct, yes. So practice now, whenever now happens to be. Okay? So if you want some more practical advice, more useful, have a look how many minutes you spend eating every day. Try and spend at least as many minutes meditating. At least. You find that time to eat, why didn't you meditate? Okay? Yeah.
When you're, if there's no will, if there is a will that's not coming from us, how, I don't know, I'm a little fuzzy on the the compelling force in the meditation process.
Yeah, because you've got no choice. You have to meditate. You try stopping meditating. Just can't do it. That's why sometimes people say, well, if there's no will, why bother? I say, you've got no choice. You have to bother. It's not up to you. You can't decide I'm not going to bother.
So there's no point in being frustrated about your progress.
Correct. Don't get frustrated. It's like that simile I gave, I think you lost that simile that I gave in the first night. It's like a person, many people from Singapore, from Penang, you're going home on the aeroplane, and some people, they get on the plane, they rush to the front. They're striving, thinking that if they rush to the front of the aircraft, they're going to get to Singapore first. They're going to get there quicker than everybody else. And other people are really lazy, they linger at the back of the plane. They don't put any effort whatsoever. And you're saying, oh, those lazy guys at the back, they're not putting forth any effort, they're not going to get to Singapore at all. We all get to Singapore at the same time. So, you've got no choice. So there we go. So I'm lazy, or I'm diligent. It's not you. You are neither lazy, you are neither diligent. You're just not there. Diligence happens, sometimes you take your lazy, which is part of the process, the body is tired, the mind is tired. Let's carry on. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry? Oh, you didn't have any choice. It's too powerful, because sometimes you go to places and sometimes at the energy in the heart couldn't quite resonate with the energy in his mind. Talking about that, once and only once was I allowed to go into Ajahn Chah's heart when he was still alive. I must have been about 7 or 8 years as a monk by this time. And he asked me to go up and get something from his room. And actually to go into Ajahn Chah's room is a great privilege. This is actually, you can get a teacher, and you can teach them amazing things. But is that how he lives? So I went to see into the room where Ajahn Chah is. I always remember that, I'm just so inspired. All that was in the room was just one mat, a grass mat. He had a wooden pillar, just one robe on the line. And that was it. That was the possessions of Ajahn Chah. When he was one of the most famous monks in time. And people just falling over themselves to give him things. He had nothing. That's the sign of enlightened being. It's just not what they say, it's how they live. It would have taken him 1 minute to pack up all his worldly belongings and go somewhere else. That's all. How long did it take you to pack before you came here? How many bags are you going to carry out on Sunday? Oh my goodness. And it's so inspiring actually to see like a real monk. Someone had just so little stuff. And that was just, whoa, can I stay in a room like that? It was just too pure. So this is actually what happens sometimes when you go into such places where great monks are. Ooh. Okay, yeah.
So, it is said that knows where the person is, another person is the
No, because sometimes arahats make mistakes. Only a Buddha can really know if a person's enlightened or not. There's a very interesting sutta. In the time of the Buddha, somebody asked the Buddha, said, all these monks were supposed to be enlightened. Are they all enlightened? Or none of them, or what? And the Buddha said, all these monks are said enlightened. Some are, some aren't. Basically, he said, even I can't tell them they're not. I just don't believe even me. That's the Buddha talking. So sometimes, what that means is sometimes that you have the same condition as an enlightened being, sometimes many months or many years. Defilements are just subdued because of the power of samadhi, power of jhanas. But sometimes they come up again afterwards, they flare up. Sometimes it's quite hard for those monks because to all intents and purposes they really think they are enlightened. They're not being scallywags, they just they get deceived by the power of samadhi. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes they are. So the only way that even the Buddha said that you can know that those are enlightened or not is to live with them for a long time, to see them over a long period. And then you can find out. Does that make sense? So live as observe them over a long period. Especially when they're in difficulties. To see whether they really get angry, whether they're afraid, when they're about to die. Or, you know, they just really get overburdened with the pain. Okay?
Could they detect themselves whether they have any of the themes of it?
Oh yeah, the thing is that you can know very clearly that you're not enlightened, and you can very easy to tell that somebody else is not enlightened. They get angry, they have lust, they got fear or something. But if they haven't got those signs, it doesn't always mean that they are enlightened. So it's easy to know a person is not enlightened, but it's hard to know a person is enlightened. I think we have to stop there, because it's interview time. And if we don't have interview time, I'm going to get into big trouble with all the people who are waiting to tell me their secrets. So, please, interview time now. If you don't want to go on the interview, please put a cross next to your names, because I put lines for each particular day. So today is Thursday, so those people on the Thursday list, if you don't want to come, please put a cross in your name so that I can actually don't have to wait there and say, when is he coming? When is he coming? Okay, so put crosses on your names. Okay, so those who come to the interviews, please come to the interviews. Those who are not coming to the interviews, you've got no choice this morning, you have to meditate.